A very good morning to everyone. The first case on our call this morning is number 063328, Larry Mays against the City of Hammond and others. Mr. Jensen.
The judgment on the verdict below cannot be sustained on the basis of Monell principles articulated by the United States Supreme Court and as applied by this court. If it is left standing, it will constitute a significant and unprecedented expansion of Monell liability. And the reasons for that are simple. This is a case in which there was absolutely no evidence offered, no evidence was even attempted to be offered, of a pattern of unconstitutional activity on the part of the Hammond Police Department. As a result, there is no basis for the claim which went to the jury, which was a failure to train claim, when there was absolutely no notice that there was a problem with regard to training, which gave rise to unconstitutional actions taken by the police department.
Was there an allegation, though, that there was no policy established for some of these areas?
Yes, there was an allegation that there was no policy. But clearly, as the evidence showed in this case, number one, with regard to exhibit number 93, which is the report of the training and personnel department for 1980, there were over 1,300 days of training for Hammond police officers during calendar 1980.
But the issue was raised by the pleading.
But not what went to the trial, not what went to the jury. The jury.
You mean the evidence failed, not that the claim was not there?
The claim was made, but what the jury was instructed was with regard to three issues. One, with regard to Officer Townsell, did he violate Larry Mays' rights when he failed to disclose supposedly exculpatory evidence with regard to a hypnosis session which took place sometime after October 6, 1980, when LJ, the rape victim, had identified Mays, and October 19, 1980, when the vehicle in which she was abducted was discovered. Number two, whether Townsell or Lieutenant Michael Solon were failed to disclose Brady material based upon a conversation that Townsell had with Solon after the interview on October 6th, that he had, quote, a tentative identification. And then three, with regard to Hensley materials, whether or not Townsell was guilty of multiple violations with regard to the failure to document. And then those, in order to impose liability on the city, were based simply on a failure to train claim. The jury did not hear evidence at the time of the trial, because there was none, that in other investigations and in other cases, there was a pattern of constitutional violations. The plaintiff totally and completely eschewed that as a basis for liability in this case. And there is no dispute with regard to this. So this is a case in which the failure to train allegation is predicated solely on one allegedly failed investigation, the Larry Mays case. And as this court held just 8 months before we tried the Mays case in the Alexander versus City of South Bend case, in which there were alleged to have been multiple errors in the course of one investigation, that would not be sufficient to predicate Monell liability against the City of South Bend because, among other things, there was no evidence of other failed lineups or identification procedures. Now, that becomes specifically significant in this case because the policymaker, Chief Frank Dupay, was granted summary judgment. And the reason he, the policymaker, was granted summary judgment because, quote, there is no evidence of a pattern of known constitutional violations that would have alerted Dupay that the lack of training constituted a policy leading to the deprivation of constitutional rights. In other words, before we even went to trial, applying that indisputably correct principle of law, Dupay, the policymaker, was already exonerated from the case. But the court nevertheless instructed with regard to the city of Hammond that its liability could be determined based upon a single act. In other words, the court said, after reciting what the allegations were against Townsell and Lieutenant Solon, and saying that the city's Monell liability was based upon the failure to train, it said that the failure to train had to arise from a custom, policy, or practice, and it may be proved by, quote, a single act. Now, the single act theory of liability in failure to train was rejected by the United States Supreme Court in Tuttle in 1985. And a single investigation theory of liability was rejected by this court in the city of South Bend in January of 2006. So we were confronted in this case with an unprecedented set of circumstances that would basically impose absolute liability on the city, even though its policymaker, the chief, was exonerated, and even though there was no pattern which would have put it on notice that there was a problem, which should have required the policymaker to embark upon a different or improved set of training. And the particular vice of this instruction, and Justice O'Connor foresaw this in her concurring opinion in the Harris case, was the particular vice in this case was that the city was charged with Monell liability with regard to Lieutenant Solon on a theory of a failure to train him. Whereas in this case, everybody agreed that the best trained officer in the department was Lieutenant Solon. He was the most knowledgeable, he was the best trained, and he had the most interactions with everybody at the prosecutor's office with regard to constitutional issues. Nevertheless, the city, on a single act theory, with this general verdict, could have been held liable for Lieutenant Solon simply on the basis of this one act, which was, in this particular case, the purported failure to disclose that Lisa, that in the after the interview, Officer Townsell had said, I have a, quote, tentative identification. So that's what the evidence in this case was, and that's what was used as the basis in the instructions. So we were stuck with a situation in which, despite the fact that everyone agreed, and the plaintiff agrees, that no evidence was ever admitted of any other investigations in which there were constitutional violations, there was no evidence admitted that the city had this kind of a custom, which because of its permanence could have become a policy because of inaction on the part of its policymakers to try to deal with it. Nevertheless, the city could be liable in a claim against its best trained officer, Lieutenant Solon, on a single act because of his failure to disclose that there was a problem, supposedly, with the identification of October 6th, and the word tentative had been used by Townsell to describe something that had arisen during that matter. This is the vice of what happened below, and this is the reason that liability based upon the Monell Doctrine cannot apply. It is absolutely unprecedented. Now, we've heard from time to time for the plaintiff, well, you didn't have a program, but clearly we had a program for training, and clearly, as you can tell by the evidence in this case, the officers involved knew what to do with regard to Brady material. There was extensive documentation by officers Mack and McPhillips when they statement-tied LJ on November 17, 1980. That evidence was put into the record. When Lieutenant Solon took over a portion of the investigation, when there was an allegation that a Charles Johnson was in fact the rapist as opposed to Mr. Mays, he statementized Charles Johnson. That was placed in the police file. And he confronted the accuser, LJ, with regard to whether or not Charles Johnson was the man that she could identify with regard to this. That statement was made a part of the record. There were multiple statements, including a statement by Officer Mizak, who conducted the in-person lineup. And he specifically noted in the in-person lineup that in this particular instance, LJ walked into the room and identified the wrong person. and then after a period of time identified Mays.
You're into your rebuttal time. Do whatever you want.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. We'll hear now from Mr. Kurowski.
Thank you, Your Honor. I, in filing my brief, joined in the arguments not on the Monell issues with the Hammond, but I did join in the issues raised in their brief with respect to evidentiary questions, which we raised at the trial level. And on my brief, I relied specifically on the issues of the failure to grant my client Michael Solon qualified immunity, and I also raised issues with regard to some of the evidence which was kept from the jury, which we think went to the state of mind of my client, and also to whether or not he was actively involved in the supervisory liability claim. The only evidence in the record, the only evidence in the entire record that was a basis for the alleged Brady violation, which was the failure of my client supposedly to disclose that there had been a tentative identification on October 6th that made by LJ, in this case, the complaining witness. That testimony came 25 years after the trial of Mr. Mays, came in a deposition where my client had not reviewed the trial transcripts and spoke of this tentative identification, which he later explained, and is in the record, is pointed out. He later determined that the tentative identification had nothing to do with the complaining witness being tentative. In fact, she testified on all occasions that she was absolutely positive of the identification. The great reason the tentative issue came up was because Detective Townsville, who was interviewing the complaining witness, had noted from the report taken on October 5th, which was the actual day of the crime, just a couple hours after the crime occurred, the report reflected that the alleged defendant had a gold tooth. And the witness, LJ, identified a picture of Mr. Mays. However, in the picture was of Mr. Mays with his mouth closed. Mr. Townsville, the detective, was not certain whether or not Mr. Mays had a gold tooth, and it was that that gave rise to the tentative identification. There's no question that at the time of the trial, Brady was in effect and that Brady violations would be the basis for a claim. However, the Brady violation alleged here, I submit to this court, was bootstrapped because they tried to show that the identification was tentative as to the complaining witness, and there is no evidence in the record from the complaining witness that she was ever in any way tentative. And based on that, I think the court, in its summary judgment, denied the qualified immunity, saying that there was a triable issue of fact. But as we know, we can revisit that issue of qualified immunity after all the facts have come into evidence. I raised that qualified immunity at the close of plaintiff's case. I also raised it after the verdict. I believe that the court erred in not granting Detective Solon qualified immunity because there was no established right, and I don't know that there's an established right even to this day, that there's any burden or obligation on a police officer to disclose to the prosecutor or the defense that the tentative identification was not the tentativeness of the complaining witness, but rather the tentativeness of the officer, who in fact was trying to do his job because he wanted to confirm that the person who had been identified by LJ did in fact have a gold tooth, which turned out to be true. And the gold tooth was exactly where the witness had said it would be. So at the time that Detective Solon was sitting at trial and allegedly heard them testify that it was a positive identification and that he did not disclose that it was tentative, in the light of all circumstances of this case, there would be no reason for him to have a reason to disclose that, because in his mind he knew that the tentative identification was the officer's, that the officer was trying to confirm. With respect to the evidence in this case, I've raised the issue specifically with respect to the supervisory liability claim. The original complaint in this case was filed and suggested that there was some type of a a conspiracy on the part of the Hammond Police Department to frame Mays, and it morphed itself into this Brady violation. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kurowski. We'll hear now from Mr. Stainthorpe.
Good morning, Judge. A jury sitting in the city of Hammond found that the city of Hammond had a policy of failure to train and supervise in relation to the production of exculpatory evidence, which directly caused the violation of May's right to a fair trial, because it directly led to the suppression of exculpatory evidence in this case. And it directly led not to one, just the suppression of one piece of evidence, but multiple pieces of evidence.
What evidence was there that there was such a policy?
The evidence actually was primarily, was mostly undisputed and was overwhelming.
Tell me what it was.
There was repeated admissions from the city of Hammond with respect to several areas. First of all, they repeatedly...
The only area I want to know about is what's the evidence that was a policy of Hammond having to do with the Brady violation.
Okay. It's a failure of to train officers
properly
record exculpatory evidence. Solon admitted there was no formal training with respect to such an obligation. Seaman, who was the other lieutenant, admitted there was no training with respect to obligation. DuPay, the police chief, said he had no idea what training, if any, was being offered. Mizak, the person who didn't disclose the hypnosis, he admitted that when he became a detective, he had no training. So there was repeated admissions by Hammond, by Solon as a 30B6
witness. I understand that the obligation under Brady is for prosecution to turn over material known to them, which then will be exculpatory or will assist the defense.
Exactly.
Is that a policy that is required under Brady of the police department or the prosecution?
What the police are required to do is record exculpatory evidence and turn it over.
What the Brady case says?
Yes. Brady says that exculpatory evidence must be turned over to the prosecutor. The prosecutor then makes the decision whether to produce it to the defense.
I'm not stating my question clearly enough. Does Brady suggest there's any obligation on the part of the police department to do anything other than to keep their normal records?
Brady absolutely says if their normal records don't record exculpatory evidence...
Says?
Yes, absolutely. A police department must record exculpatory evidence. It's the very essence of Brady.
Brady has to do with the delivery of material by the prosecution to the defendant before trial.
Exactly.
Known to them. And I'm wondering whether or not you can find an obligation on the part of the department to write down what, so that they would know what would be exculpatory material and so on.
First of all,
I'm relatively familiar with Brady, but
I understand that, Judge. But Hammond has never, ever claimed that they don't have a burden to record exculpatory evidence. That's never been an issue in the case.
What evidence, other than this case, is there that the Hammond police did not deliver exculpatory material to anybody else?
Our evidence was in relation to the training, supervision, and regulation, and that the officers did not understand what their obligation was. Let's look at what Mr. Jansen was claiming, which that Solon was the best trained officer. By the way, that's not in the record anywhere, and it's a misrepresentation of the record. But let's look at what Solon did in this case. Solon, who according to Mr. Jansen is the best trained officer, he knew about the identification procedures on October the 6th, knew that it was a tentative identification, knew that it was not recorded, knew that three photographs of Mays, three photographs were shown in this identification procedure, only one photograph of anyone else, knew that that wasn't recorded, knew that only two of those three photographs were apparently tentatively ID'd, that wasn't recorded, knew that there was a photograph of Mays that was not identification, that wasn't recorded, he knew that, he knew there was no statement taken from the victim on October the 6th, he knew that there was no recording of the subsequent interview with Bertha Allen that Townsell did. No recording of that for 6 months. No preservation of the photo arrays on the October the 6th ID. No preservation of the photo arrays in the Bertha Allen identification. All of these things Solon is directly involved with. He knows that there's an insufficient recording of the lineup. This is their best trained officers who repeatedly says, and now he claims not to know about the hypnosis session back in 1980 and 81. But now he says the failure to record in any manner that hypnosis session is fully in accordance with our policies. These are our policies. You can do it. You can do this session. You can do this session, which we established was hypnosis, was highly suggestive, and you don't need to record it. You can then have this session after the hypnosis, where Lisa Jane says she thinks it was an hour-long session. And then there's a subsequent session where she's shown photographs, where she gives a description. You don't have to record that. Solon says, that's fine. This is our training. This is our policy. This is our regulation. This is our supervision. You don't have to record any of this.
Stainthorpe, where do Hammond police officers receive their initial police training?
Well, I back in that period, there was very little evidence.
Indiana Police Academy?
They had some kind of police academy, but not for detectives. There was absolutely zero training for detectives, except let's look at the training for detectives in 1980. What was the one training that's in the that's relevant to this case, that's in the annual report? Hypnosis training. Mizak is sent for hypnosis training. It shows up in the annual report. This is our training for detectives, completely contrary to the policy of Hammond, supposedly. So we have a slew of evidence, both with respect to admissions from Hammond that there was no training, no regulation, no supervision, nothing written down, and then we see the effects of this in this case. So there is essentially admitted the facts of the failure to train. There's really no dispute about it, that those are the facts. Those are the facts that the jury heard. The jury in this case was consistently told it could not impose liability on Hammond for one act. It could not. It was repeatedly told. The only way you find Hammond liable is if you find they have a policy of failure to train with respect to the production and recording of exculpatory evidence. Mr. Jensen and the City of Hammond throughout this litigation has completely ignored the holding of City of Canton. City of Canton could not be clearer. It says that a municipality may be found liable when, quote, in light of the duties assigned to the specific officers, the need for more or different training is so obvious and the inadequacy so likely to result in the violation of constitutional rights that the policymakers of the city can reasonably be said to have been deliberately indifferent to the need.
If the policy of the city in training was to say, you are to record all facts pertinent to the inquiry, would that be sufficient?
What's the evidence?
There is
no evidence of that.
Pause. If the policy of the city were to say the police officer should record all pertinent events around an investigation and preserve them, would that be sufficient?
Yes, I think that would be.
Good.
That would be sufficient, and that absolutely was not their policy.
You can keep on with that. All I want to know is be sufficient?
If they recorded all the facts.
So if the police officer sincerely believes that he's putting down what he thinks are pertinent matters, that is sufficient?
If a police officer... there's an objective standard. For instance, it would be objectively unreasonable, and it was objectively unreasonable, for Mizak and Townsell to fail to record the hypnosis session and the subsequent interview with with Lisa Janes. It's not a subjective standard with respect to that.
But that wouldn't have anything to do with the policy. That would mean that they failed to follow the policy.
But what we know in this case is Hammond has admitted time and again that...
Well, we started out with my question as to whether or not, if the city said, you shall record all pertinent matters concerning a criminal investigation, would that be sufficient? You said yes.
Yes, I agree.
All right. And if, then, a failure to do that would be a failure on the part of the officer to follow the rules, not the failure of the city to have a rule.
Yeah, let's see. Yes, well, that's correct. Now, and the city, in their brief, cited their rules and regulations of the police department precisely along the lines that you're talking about, Judge, and said that those rules and regulations call for the those relate to the recording and production of exculpatory evidence. This is what the jury heard. This is what the jury heard from the police chief at the time. Quote, a question, being handed these rules and regulations, which are in their brief. You told me that was the place where if there were going to be any rules and regulations concerning ID procedures or documenting evidence or disclosing exculpatory evidence, that's where it would be, right? Right. Is there anything in there about ID procedures that you know of? No, I don't see anything. Nothing in the table of contents. Anything about documenting evidence? No. Anything about disclosing exculpatory evidence? No. So this is the evidence that the jury heard. They then heard from Seaman. Seaman's the other lieutenant besides Solon at the time of this case. Is it fair to say you don't remember any policies or procedures that address the requirement that police officers or detectives had to disclose exculpatory or impeachment evidence? I don't remember seeing anything like that. And then we have Solon. Solon saying there were no written regulations with regard to documenting and disclosing exculpatory evidence. So, in fact, in this case, if you look at those rules and regulations which Hammond now says contained that obligation to record exculpatory evidence, and in fact, also Roughline, our expert, talked about those and said they are completely inadequate, that the rules and regulations did not set forth the obligation to record and disclose exculpatory evidence. That evidence was unrebutted. There was no one who contradicted Roughline on that. Now, on appeal, Hammond wants to sing a different tune. They want to say, oh, these rules and regulations were sufficient to set forth the officer's obligations to record exculpatory evidence. But in fact, we also have additional admissions from the city of Hammond that the failure to record in this case, the failure to record all these items of both exculpatory evidence and evidence of suggestive identification procedures, those a complete failure to record those. Townsell never made a report. The whole investigation, the main detective, never made a report, never said it was a tentative identification, never reported on the failure of Lisa Janes to pick out a photograph. The Hammond has admitted that was their policy. That was consistent with their policy. That was consistent with their training, their supervision, and their regulation. So with respect to the evidence that the jury heard, there were repeated admissions and essentially undisputed testimony as to what that policy was. Now, Hammond has never accepted that you can prove a policy pursuant to City of Canton and the holding of City of Canton, that where you show a need for training and where you show that there is inadequate training and show that if you have inadequate training, you are likely to have constitutional violations, that may constitute a municipal policy. But here, that was our theory. And that was our theory throughout the case. We never wavered from that theory. And the district court was correct in accepting that theory at summary judgment, was correct in accepting that theory with respect to the Rule 50 motions. And notably, At trial, the city never argued that our proof was inadequate to show that theory. All they argued was that City of Canton essentially should be ignored in this case. The holding of City of Canton, the holding of this court in numerous cases, in Woodward, Davis, Sornberger, Jones against City of Chicago, Jenkins even, the new case just cited yesterday afternoon by the City of Hammond. All of those cases accept that there's two ways of proving a failure to train case. One way is to show the repeated instances of constitutional violations. And the other, separate way, is to show that there is a need for training, that the training is inadequate, that it is likely to cause constitutional violations, and then, of course, to show that it wasn't the moving force behind the violations in this case. Once more, with respect to the moving force, the proof here was essentially undisputed that had there been any training in effect, had there been any supervision in effect, had there been regulations in effect, this evidence would have been disclosed. It's not difficult. The duty here is not difficult, but it is a duty that officers need training on because it is a counterintuitive obligation. Officers, and the officers particularly in this case, want to catch the bad guys. And when they feel that they've got a bad guy who might be guilty, it is a counterintuitive obligation to record evidence which tends to undermine that evidence. But in this, so it is an area in which training is needed. It is an area in which training makes a difference. If you have those regulations, if you have that supervision, if you set forth some very simple rules, and then if you have the supervisors looking at what the detectives are doing and saying, did you do that? Did you record it? And if they didn't record it, they get into trouble. That's what you need in a police department. You've got to have rules. You've got to have supervision. You've got to have the training. The officers have to know that they need to
record. I want to get back to my basic question, and maybe the City of Hammond did not raise it. Where do they receive their basic training? In the Indiana State Police Academy, where most municipalities receive their training?
Yeah. I think that the officers in this case receive training at various different places. But, Judge, I don't think there's much in the record about that because the training that we were concentrating on was not basic training to be a police officer. It's not how to put your uniform on or how to get to roll call on time or where you holster your gun. No. The training we're talking about is very specific training. It is quite simple training. It's not expensive training. It's not something that you need some fancy instructor. But you do have to, and the proof on this was undisputed, that you do have to train officers on their duty to record and produce exculpatory evidence.
This was from witnesses that you produced?
Yes, it was. First of all, we had various admissions by officers the primary evidence on the failure to train claim came from our expert, yes, and that was Steve Rothline, who was the former deputy head of the Miami-Dade Police Department, and essentially he wasn't even cross-examined on this issue. He wasn't cross-examined. There was no questioning of by Hammond as to whether this was an area in which training was needed, as to whether this was an area in which the failure to train would naturally cause or likely cause constitutional violations. That wasn't even disputed. If you look at the cross-examination of Rothline at trial, it's primarily designed to show that Mr. Mays was a bad man. It was primarily designed to show that to prejudice the jury against Mr. Mays. That's how they tried the case below. They tried to make the jury forget about the failure to disclose exculpatory evidence and to not look at the comprehensive failure to train, regulate, and supervise in this case. We never at any time argued that Hammond should be liable because they employed Solon, Townsell, Mizek. It was always absolutely clear we had to prove a policy. And the jury was instructed that we had to prove a policy, and they were instructed precisely in accordance with City of Canton. That was their instruction. It was word for word from City of Canton that a municipal policy of failure to train, can be proven in this way. You prove the need, you prove that the training was inadequate, you prove that, that's likely to cause constitutional violations, and then you establish that it's the moving force behind the violation here. Once you've done that, you've satisfied City of Canton, and the jury is entitled to return a verdict, as they did here, in favor of the plaintiff. There's no new law here. The concept that we're extending the law, that this is an extension of Monell, is ridiculous. And the only reason that Hammond is taking that tack is because they apparently now recognize, and the first time they recognize this is in their reply brief, but they apparently now recognize that that holding of City of Canton is a viable way of holding them liable. And you won't see it in their summary judgment, you won't see it in their Rule 50 motions, you won't see it in their opening brief, but in their reply brief is the first time they acknowledge, yes, we could be held liable based on that, and then draw this absurd distinction between adequate training and no training, which has no support in the cases and is on its face is absurd, because City of Canton was a case where there was some training. So City of Canton involved inadequate training rather than no training. So we do need to concentrate on the evidence that was heard by the jury. And the evidence that was heard by the jury and can be credited in this case was that there was no training, no supervision, no regulation with respect to that duty to record exculpatory evidence, and that was a failure which would likely cause constitutional violations such as those caused in this case. With respect to the evidence that was withheld, the evidence that was not disclosed, obviously we have the tentative identification on October the 6th, which was misrepresented as positive at trial. Oh, by the way, the concept that that LJ was never unsure about her identification is also, that's not in accordance with the facts. That's another fact that Hammond has made up. The way this first came to light was that the prosecutor in 2001 who was doing the DNA testing, Kate O'Halloran, called up the victim and said, did you ever have any problems identifying Larry Mays? I said, well, not after hypnosis. So the concept that she was always positive is just not in accordance with the facts. Those aren't the facts that the jury heard. The jury heard that her perception is that she didn't ID him until after the hypnosis. The facts tended to show that was accurate. She made some kind of tentative ID on October the 6th when she's shown three photographs of Larry Mays, only one of anyone else. And then...
Well, she didn't describe it as tentative, though.
And that's the important thing. She didn't back in 81 and 82.
That was a characterization of the officer rather than the witness. The witness didn't indicate any tentative feeling about it, even before hypnosis, right?
Okay. But the officer's perception that she was tentative is in itself exculpatory evidence. Certainly, in a case like this, where the sole issue is identification, there is nothing else that specifically ties Larry Mays to this crime. So ID is crucial. ID, and Rothline stressed how important it is in ID cases that you record everything, that you record what the witness says, that certainly you don't show multiple photos of one person, as was done in this case, three photos of Larry Mays on October the 6th, then that's not recorded. So certainly you need to record every aspect of the identification procedure. And there's also admissions. It's not just Solon's statement in the in his deposition that Townsell told me it was a tentative identification. We have admissions from Solon as a 30B6 witness for Hammond that the first positive identification of the victim of Mays in this case comes on November 17th. November 17th, everyone agrees, is after the hypnosis, and obviously indicates that the identification on October the 6th was tentative, as we always argued at trial. There was a tentative identification. It had to be disclosed as a tentative identification. And by the way, there is no contrary evidence with respect to that. The evidence is if an identification is tentative, it must be disclosed. That was acknowledged by Hammond. That was admitted by Hammond. The jury in this case, for any number of reasons, was entitled to find that the October the 6th ID was tentative, despite the testimony of Janes back in 82 that she was positive. Why was the no arrest warrant issued for Mays after October the 6th? Why was there no effort to find out if he had a gold tooth? Why did nothing go forward? Why was there no recording? They say, Hammond says that they were good at recording stuff and goes through everything they recorded. Everything they recorded was material which tended to show Mays was guilty. But everything that, or almost everything, that tended to show Mays was not guilty was not recorded. So what you have here is a policy precisely in a, or a actions precisely in accordance with the failure to train. You have that affirmative link between the failure to train and the actions of the officers in this case, that they did not record exculpatory evidence, that they did record inculpatory evidence, and that the failure to record exculpatory evidence was crucial. One quick point on the cross appeal. The cross appeal, Mizak failed to record the hypnosis session. The evidence was he had an independent duty as a detective to record it, and that also that he consciously and intentionally failed to reveal the hypnosis under questioning back in 1980, in the early 1980s, 82, I believe, at his deposition. Clearly, that was a credibility question, which the district court should not have decided in Mizak's favor and should have allowed that case to go to trial. With DuPay, the issue is a legal issue. The issue is, did he have to be personally involved in the Mays investigation? No question he wasn't personally involved in the Mays investigation. So the legal issue is, did he have to be personally involved in order to be liable for a failure to have rules, regulations, and supervision in this case? Now, he acknowledged he had that duty, and he essentially acknowledged that he breached that duty. And it is our position that you don't have to have personal involvement for his personal liability, that that was enough to render him liable. I think I'm just about up with time. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Apparently not, Mr. Steinfeld. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Banaszek.
May it please the court, counsel. I have two issues to discuss today regarding the appeal of Larry Mays against my client Raymond Mizak. The first issue is the waiver of the appeal of Mays, and the second issue is the lack of merit of the appeal of Mays. As an appellant, Mays has a central duty to prepare and file an appellant brief outlining and developing all the issues as part of the appeal. As part of this appellant brief, Mays asked for and received an extension in page limit in an effort to be able to present a good appeal against my client, Raymond Mizak. This circuit has case law governing the raising and supporting of issues on appeal, and that's in the case of U.S. versus Lanzotti. This court has held that a party asking this court to reverse a district court judgment has an obligation to argue why this court should reverse that judgment and cite appropriate authority in order to do so. Lanzotti also held that appellate courts do not sit as self-directed boards of legal inquiry and research. And Lanzotti finally holds that it's not the court's responsibility to construct and research arguments of the parties. Mays violates all of these tenets of Lanzotti. If the court would review Mays' primary brief, you will note that there are approximately 15 lines of text in the argument section devoted to my client. In addition, there is a three-line footnote. As part of that argument, there is nothing, no cites to authority, no cases being developed. Mays cites one case in that entire appeal, and that is in the standard of review section, and that is not even developed as part of this particular case. This circuit, in the case of Weinstein versus Schwartz, has further held that perfunctory and undeveloped arguments and arguments unsupported by pertinent authority are waived. Mays is certainly aware of this standard, as he cited the same case earlier in his principal brief, essentially saying another party to the appeal had failed to develop certain arguments and therefore they were perfunctory and waived. Despite the fact that Mays was aware of the standard, he certainly didn't apply it in his brief against my client, Raymond Mizak. It should be noted that this court, that Mays, in an effort to resurrect his appeal, essentially initiated his appeal in the reply brief. A review of the reply brief shows that there are approximately 8 pages of text in the argument section, compared again to the 15 lines that were in the initial brief. None of these reply arguments should be considered by this court. Again, the Seventh Circuit has addressed this issue in the case of Rogers versus City of Chicago and has held that this court should not consider arguments withheld until the reply brief. May's main arguments in his appeal were withheld until the reply brief. And as a result of this fact, due to the close of the briefing schedule, Mizak was prevented from filing a written response to those particular arguments. In essence, what happened is Mays sandbagged my client, Raymond Mizak, and perhaps, and certainly more importantly, sandbagged this court with this briefing tactic. The ironic fact about this is I cautioned the court about this potential tactic in my original brief, and despite this warning, Mays flaunted it and continued to brief in that same manner. This type of briefing tactic should not be rewarded by this court, and I would ask that the court strike the appeal as being waived according to the aforementioned authority. Now, in the event the court were willing to review this case on the merits, I would also submit that May's appeal fails on its own merits, whatever merits were raised initially. Mays is arguing to this court that the district court made an impermissible credibility decision regarding evidence presented at the summary judgment stage. There were also some arguments raised in the reply brief regarding Mizak does not contest hiding material evidence and Mizak does not contest the fact that he should have disclosed this evidence to the court. Those issues were never reached and decided by the district court based on the way the Brady law was held, and the court did not feel the need to reach those issues. So we did not contest them in this appeal because they weren't raised in this appeal and that wasn't part of the appeal. The district court found that Mays did not come forward with specific facts demonstrating that Mizak deliberately withheld information in the original criminal proceeding. Instead, the district court found that Mays relied upon inferences drawn from events and inferences drawn by Mays that were too attenuated and speculative to defeat summary judgment. Mays presented no evidence at the summary judgment stage to contradict Mizak's testimony that he did not deliberately withhold evidence. Instead, Mays is telling us that because Mizak said these things, he must be lying, and the jury should have an opportunity to hear Mizak on the stand and judge his credibility on the stand to see if he's lying. This court, in the case of Giannopoulos versus Brock, stands for the proposition that that a plaintiff cannot avoid summary judgment as a matter of law because a jury might not believe the defendant's properly supported arguments. There's another case that deals with this type of credibility issue, and it's also a Seventh Circuit case of Washington versus Hopper. And it stands for the proposition that the court will not engage in a swearing contest between litigants, one side versus the other. Here we have Mizak presenting one side, Mays presenting nothing in rebuttal. The court never reached a credibility determination in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll hear next from Mr. Kurowski.
Your Honor, with respect to the cross-appeal with my client, a former chief of police, Frank Dupe, I would join in the arguments submitted by Mr. Beneziak that Mr. Mays has, in effect, waived the appeal. His brief consists of approximately 2 paragraphs addressed to Mr. Dupe's alleged participation in the matters before the court, And the court found at the trial level that Frank Dupe was not deliberately indifferent. He may not have been as involved as he should have been, but the court did make a determination that he was not deliberately indifferent to the rights of Mr. Mays. And in fact, in briefing this, the plaintiff has referred on numerous occasions in his brief with respect to trial testimony, which of course would not go to the issue with regard to Frank Dupe, since he was directed out at the summary judgment stage.
Counsel, one of the difficulties I have with your position, I guess, is that Morrill seems to invite us to hold that someone who is statutorily in charge can pretty much insulate himself from liability by burying his head in the sand, becoming terribly informed and not becoming terribly proactive. Your client's position seems to be that of the proverbial ostrich.
I don't think it's the position of the proverbial ostrich, Your Honor. I think it's the position that, with respect to his personal liability, that there should have to be some evidence presented by the plaintiff that he was actually involved in this deprivation or alleged deprivation of constitutional rights, which at the summary judgment stage, at least, there was no evidence to that effect.
So, assuming arguendo,
yes,
that there was a violation of constitutional rights here by a lack of training, somebody down the line from the chief wasn't training. The chief can escape liability by just saying, "Hey, I told those guys to take care of whatever they need to be taken care of."
I believe that the law is, Your Honor, that the chief of police can. I'm not saying it's the best procedure, but he can delegate such authority. And I think this court has held that on occasion. And again, with respect to the arguments, I would just say that he has waived those arguments because he didn't devote enough time to it. And additionally, he's not addressed this issue from the perspective of the summary judgment stage, which was all that the court had to work with at the time.
Thank you. See, now, I guess, Mr. Jensen, it's time for your rebuttal.
Apropos Judge Kaney's questions, the training information is in your appendix, and it's included in Exhibits 91, 92, and 93. 91 includes Robert Townsell's training in accordance with state law. 92 includes Raymond Mizak's training in accordance with state law. 93 includes the training for the whole division, including the training at the basic police training course in Plainfield. This court has said on two occasions, at least, in Ross at 343 North Fed 3rd 915 and in Tapia 965 Fed 2nd 336 that it will not impose any additional training standards beyond those imposed by state law. And it is the plaintiff, in this case Mays, who bears that responsibility under Tapia, and he didn't discharge it. In other words, there was no testimony elicited that any of the training that was in evidence in this case fell below the standards prescribed in Title V of the Indiana Code, and therefore satisfied the responsibilities under Tapia and Ross. Secondly, this contention that there is has to be formal training is belied by the fact that everybody knew that they had a Brady obligation in this case. Absolutely everyone knew that they had a Brady obligation, and you cannot impose a formal training requirement. The issue was, did they meet the Brady requirements? And then if they didn't, was that as a result of a policy or custom on the part of the department? And you cannot prove a custom on the basis of one case. Remember, nobody in this case, including Solon, knew that hypnosis had taken place, and in fact, hypnosis was forbidden in the department, and the jury was instructed twice that Solon had told, knew nothing about it, and he in fact had told Mizak that if you go to this hypnosis seminar, you're on your own, you will not use it in our department.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. We'll hear from Mr. Kurowski next on behalf of Mr. Solon.
I'd just like to address the issue of the supervisory liability claim, which was raised by the plaintiffs and on which this went to the jury also. And with respect to that issue, we have some questions and issues regarding the evidence which was precluded in this case, and I think it went directly to the heart of the supervisory liability claim, the most egregious of which was the fact that the court, although originally had made some rulings in our favor with respect to motions in limine, reversed those rulings at the time of trial. But the most egregious lack of evidence here that we were not allowed to bring into the trial was the fact of the Larry Pisalik murder case. Larry Pisalik was an officer with the Hammond Police Department who was killed just shortly after this rape took place, and there was evidence in both cases which were the same, specifically a blue bag. And the reason it becomes important from the standpoint of my client, Mike Solon, is because the only reason Mike Solon was at the trial of Larry Mays was because of the fact that there had been overlapping evidence, and he was hoping that he would be able to hear testimony which might lead to further information in the investigation of the death of the police officer, which to this day has not been solved. So the jury was not aware that the reason that Mike Solon was there was not for the LJ case. He was there because he hoped to get other information from witnesses' testimony regarding the Pisalik murder case. That led to the uncomfortable situation for my client, where Mr. Rustin, on direct examination of my client before the jury, said, well, wasn't one of the reasons that you were at the trial was to look for exculpatory evidence? My client said yes, but we were unable on cross-examination to bring up the real reason he was there, which was, in fact, that he was there because of the overlapping evidence in the murder case. And with respect to the other rulings, the court took away the right to talk about Mr. May's prior convictions, which were for rape and robbery. We were limited to saying that they were just felony convictions. We were limited and not able to say that he had forgery convictions, which went to his credibility, that he switched his urine samples while in prison, which went to his credibility, and on and on and on.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
Had Mr. Stainthorpe, had you you had kept some time? And
I believe I indicated it. Three minutes.
On the cross-appeal, please.
Just let me raise one thing before I get to that. I think it's quite improper for Mr. Karowski to raise things on his rebuttal that were not raised in the initial argument. And with respect to Pisalik and the various items of evidence, there are...
I think we can deal with that in due course, if you would stay with the cross-appeal.
So with respect to the cross-appeal as to DuPay, the crucial training here was not basic training. It's not whether they went to
but
the police academy.
The training for police officers in Indiana is governed by state law.
The training with respect to production of exculpatory evidence is not. And even though there were standards in effect in 1980, and this was unrebutted testimony, that the International Association of Chiefs of Police, that other police departments, that there were basic standards with respect to training, regulation, and supervision of production of exculpatory evidence. Those standards existed. Those standards were not included in state law. State law had nothing to do with the training in the constitutional obligation to produce Brady material. There was no evidence that there was any state law. The state law was with respect to basic training. But there was nothing with respect to the training of detectives in this crucial obligation. And it's even though the city of Canton holds that you can be liable for a failure to train, that where the need is obvious and where the training doesn't exist, a municipality can be liable. And with respect to DuPay individually, our claim was, even though he wasn't involved in the Mays case, so even though he didn't know anything about Mays, no question, we agree with that, but that his failure to fulfill his obligation with respect to his training obligations, which he acknowledged, that failure renders him liable personally where there is a constitutional violation caused by that failure. So the difference, there is a, the district court held there was a difference. With respect to the municipal liability, the court held that you could find a municipal policy where the need for such training was obvious. So you didn't have to actually show that DuPay was personally involved in this case. The court drew a distinction between that and DuPay's personal liability. It's our position that based on the evidence that we did present at summary judgment, we didn't waive a thing, but based this was a legal issue as to whether DuPay had to be personally involved in this investigation. So there's really no dispute about the facts here. DuPay had the duty, didn't do anything, wasn't involved in Mays. Does that make him liable? And our position is that based on Seventh Circuit law, it does. With respect to Mizak, we didn't spend a lot of pages. We didn't have to. The issue was clear. Can you make that credibility determination, or is that up to a jury? This court has repeatedly said that a district court should not make that determination. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And thanks to all counsel in the case for their fine briefs and for their fine oral arguments today as well. The case will be taken under advisement.